let me start off by first asking, how many of you did not complete all of the first experiment? Okay, a few more than the first section. So how many of you just have melting points left to do? A large number of you. Okay. Normally, the lab reports are due 2 lab periods after you complete an experiment. So we technically should have completed the experiment on Monday. This is the first lab day, and then so Monday should have been the due date for the first lab report. But because we didn't all finish, I'll make it Wednesday that first lab report is due. Next Wednesday, so a week from today. It is not because you have the exam on Monday. No, I don't have that much pity. But because you didn't finish, it would be unfair for me to make the lab report due. Because I'm going to talk for most of the lab today. Because what we're going to be doing first is I'm going to talk about how to write up the lab reports. We'll take a short break, so those of you who were trying to scarf down your lunch, you'll get another chance to do so. And then the second half, we'll talk about the pre-lab for the next experiment. Muhammad, you had a question? I answered it. Okay. So lab report due Wednesday, next week. It must be either typed or computer formatted. I don't think anybody, how many of you have actually even used a typewriter? Wow, I just feel that much older today, okay. Because that's all we had when I was a kid. People didn't have computers when I was a kid. So yeah, it was that long ago. But it has to be therefore computer generated. Let me talk a little bit about formats. So, and I talk about this in the syllabus, but let me say it out loud a little bit. Most of you, I'm imagining, will probably use Microsoft Word. That's the most widely used word processing program. And Microsoft, in its infinite wisdom, has made the Mac and PC versions different from each other for a number of years now. So there is this new document format that is being used for Word documents, DocX format. It's supposed to be readable in both platforms, but at least as of last year, the equation editor, some of you know that you have an equation editor, those equations generated on the PC platform, for whatever reason, often fail when you bring them over to the Mac platform. Now, I think since that time, there's been another version of both, so maybe they easily translate now. But I have had instances in the past where someone sends in a lab report and I can't read it properly. If that happens, and what I'm building up to is I prefer emailed lab reports. It cuts down on how many trees we're wasting. So if you email me a lab report, you send it to me on time, but I have an issue reading the format, then I'll just send it back to you. It won't be counted late, but I'll ask you to just resend it in some other format. There's 2 easy solutions if you run into this problem. One, resave it as the older .doc format, because that tends to work. Or, the best format of all is PDF, because 99.9% of the time that opens on any platform. Now, on a Mac, every program can print as PDF, because every object displayed is PDF. And so if you don't know how to do it, there is a place on the print dialog on a Mac where it has a little PDF button. Simply save the file, you've got the PDF. On a PC, I don't know if Windows has that capability yet, but there is a free program you can download called PDF for Free. And I think I have the link to it on my website and in the syllabus. The truly free version of it prints a little advertising at the bottom of each page, but that's fine by me. This is not a professional publication that we're doing. You're just trying to turn in a lab report. So PDF, if you could do it, is best. Microsoft Word I can read. A variety of other programs I can read as well. I'm just letting you know ahead of time, if you send me something that I have a formatting problem with, I'll just send it back and ask you that you resubmit it. If you're not super computer savvy and you have no clue how to reformat it, then worst case scenario, turn in a printed copy. Please do not give me an emailed and printed copy. I have so many people that come to me and say, I was worried if you got the email or not. Well, I will let you know if I get the email or not. So if you're going to email me a lab report, please don't print one. Now, there will come a time where you might need to do a little of both, because at some point we're going to start getting printouts of Spectra. And since I know not everybody has a scanner, I don't make you scan spectra. If you wanted to, that'd be great, and then you could have an all-electronic report. But if you didn't, that would be fine to do part of your write-up electronic, but just the spectra, just the printouts, you can turn in paper form. Now, if you email me a lab report, and I don't know if I have this in the syllabus or not, so pay attention to this part of it. I am paranoid about grades, because there is this thing out there called FERPA, which, to boil it down, basically says, I can't release grade information to anybody else except you without your permission. Email is an insecure form of communication, meaning I could email you something, but then if your brother, sister, boyfriend, girlfriend, father, mother, somebody gets on your computer without your knowledge, they could potentially see that grade. If you send me a lab report, you need to send me something that says, effectively, I agree to receive lab grades by email. What you will be agreeing to by that, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 2, 4, 6, looks like all of you are here, so you're all hearing this. If you send me that sentence, then effectively what you're telling me is that if someone breaks into your email account, you're not going to hold me responsible if they see your grade information. I know this may sound a little paranoid, but we are sue happy in the U.S., and I don't feel like being sued for something that trivial, that small, 10-point assignment. But it is still a grade. It is still your private information. So if you want to have email grades, you need to tell me that. Otherwise, I can easily give you the feedback and the grades here in lab so that no email is ever generated. All right? Now, to the format of the lab report itself. This is going to be a somewhat reduced form of what would normally be generated in research, which a real presentation of research appears in what's called a peer-reviewed journal article. So peer-reviewed means your peers, your contemporaries, the other people working in the field. They have a chance to read whatever publication you're going to make before it gets published. So you do some research, you think that you've invented something cool, you send it to Journal of American Chemical Society, JAX for short, Angewandte Chemie, a very popular journal from Germany. A number of chemical societies around the world publish journals which contain research. So you send it to one of these journals, they send it out to different reviewers, they comment on it, they say, is this research valid? Are the procedures sound? Was something worthwhile actually discovered, or is it just filling up paper needlessly? So they go back and forth and examine it, and they send it back to you with comments. Very rarely does something get accepted the very first time. They might send even just minor comments. They might ask you to rewrite parts. They might ask you to do more research first. Eventually, once you've got a document that they're happy with, then it gets published in some form of journal, a publication. That collective body of all those journals is called the chemical literature. And that's where most discoveries end up getting published, unless it's some super secret governmental or business thing in which they won't publish all the results because there's some dollars or national secrets involved. The structure of these reports, these publications, usually works like this. You start with a one-paragraph abstract that just summarizes the whole thing, so if people are just flipping through to see what news happened, they can read the one-paragraph synopsis and get what they need from that. The more complete article itself would first present the history of the research. So who had done research in this field previously? What was important about that research? How does this project that you just did add to that knowledge? And why is it valuable, therefore? You're not only speaking to the chemistry of it, but to be realistic and maybe pessimistic, you can't do research without money. So at the same time you're publishing your results, you're also letting the grant writers, the people that are giving you the money, know why was their money used for something good. After that, you have a full, exhaustively detailed procedure. You then list all of your various forms of data and any calculations that you made. You draw whatever conclusions from that data that you can. And then you'll often discuss what further research, what you just discovered, will enable. So that sets you up to be able to do more research and sets you up to possibly get more money to do the research. Now, what you did in here with the extractions none of us are going to make any money off of. And we're not going to a peer-reviewed journal, so we don't need quite all the trappings of a traditional full report. So here's what you're going to have. A purpose statement so that you can tell me in a very short way what was the main point of the lab. You'll present your forms of data, and you'll have some calculations. Now, in the syllabus, there's a lot that I have to say about formatting. Some of it won't really apply here because this is not Chem 1A. This is not going to be a calculationally heavy lab report. So I'll talk, whatever I mention in class that you have to do, that's the limit of what you have to do. You might see it presented in a better, more eloquent form in the syllabus, but if the syllabus starts to get too deep into something that I don't even talk about, that's because the syllabus was written for both Chem 1 and Chem 12. So for this lab report, only follow the guidelines that I'm giving you in here. After the data and calculations, you'll have a conclusion statement, which is effectively a parallel with your purpose statement. So in speech classes, you might have heard something like this, that if you're going to present, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So purpose is, here's what I'm going to tell you, data and calculations, okay, here's my experiment, conclusion, all right, here's what's the point of the experiment. After that, then there's the chance for discussion. But this, I probably said this already, this is going to be different than what you might have done in your previous lab classes because I do not have you discuss theory on the lab report. So, for example, in this first experiment, you don't have to say anything about in part B used bicarbonate first to get the benzoic acid and then sodium hydroxide to get this because of the pKa's and the conjugates and weaker, and you don't have to go over any of that. That's what the lab quiz is for. So the lab quiz, you will be addressing all of those kinds of issues, but keep it out of the lab report. That lets the lab report be a bit shorter, you have a little bit less work to do all the way along. And you all are already now freaking out about the tests, so the easier the lab reports, the better in a sense. Now let me go over each one of those sections again a bit more in detail. Purpose. So the point of this lab, from a chemical perspective, has nothing to do with learning extraction. The way your lab text is written, the way I presented the lab, you might have gotten the impression it's all about learning extractions. And yeah, as students, you're learning how to do extractions. But when you're writing a report, any kind of chemical report, the person on the other end probably doesn't give a damn whether you learn something or not. They're expecting you already know it and know how to do chemistry well, and they're wanting to look at what is the research that you did. Because that's the way reports are generally written, we're going to match that in here, which means any reference to learning or anything that you learn how to do a technique, leave that out. Because that goes along philosophically with how lab reports or formal reports are generally, not always, but generally written. They're usually written entirely from a third-person perspective, meaning there's no I, me, our, we, any of those first-person words. There's no you, yours, y'all, if you're from the South, you know. None of that. It's all it. Which means these lab reports would drive English instructors batty, because at least when I was in English classes growing up, they used to pound us to say, don't make sentences like this. The book was read. They say, don't make passive constructions. Say, he read the book, to put the focus on the person. That's exactly what you don't do in a research paper. You do it the passive way. The mass was measured. The results were obtained. There's no person involved with that because the philosophy behind that is it is focusing on the science. That science is something that is logical and is above whatever human emotion we might put into it. But some people don't like that philosophy. Some people think, no, we as humans do the work, we should be honored for that work, and it should be mentioned in whatever publications that we make. Most chemistry publications follow the apersonal form. No mention of the person, so no first and second person. So tied with that, that's why you as students, although you're learning techniques, don't talk about the learning process in your purpose statement. In Chem 1A, when I do this, I say this just to see if anybody's listening, quite honestly, or if people are just copying lab reports. Because almost every lab, it starts out with the purpose of this lab is to learn how to. And so if you just blindly write that down in your lab report, I know that you're just blowing me off, which means you're going to blow me off when I give you safety warnings as well. So that's why I do that in a Chem 1 class. Here you're hopefully more sophisticated, so if I tell you focus on the science, not the learning, that you'll just do it. So with all that backdrop, let me say that the purpose statement is a concise statement of the qualitative or quantitative goals in an experiment. Qualitative means without numbers. So you're looking for a precipitate, or you're looking to synthesize something, or to see if bubbles form, or something like that. That's what qualitative means. Quantitative means your goal is to get the melting point, the boiling point. So what would be a good purpose statement for this experiment? And that might stump you, because again, so far the whole focus has been on what is extraction. But what do we use extraction for? Why do we measure all these different masses? What do you think a reasonable purpose statement would be to make based on what activities we did? Yeah. Something like to determine the composition of two unknown mixtures. Period. Because yeah, you measured melting point, but that was just to check purity. That wasn't the goal. And yes, you measured masses to recover the stuff, but again, that's just learning. And so if we're not focusing on the learning, what did we do? We figured out how much of each compound is in each mixture. Yeah.
So you just want to see lots of space.
That's right. If you can do everything, if you can describe in enough detail that you completely express what happened in the experiment and it only takes you one page of a lab report, that's beautiful. I do not want people writing paragraph after paragraph thinking the heavier the lab report, the better the grade will be. Because usually the more people talk, the more bad science starts showing up in what they say. And I'll give you some examples of what I mean by that in a minute. So yes, cut, dry, to the point. That's what I want to see. Now, I didn't write this purpose statement down because I want you to think, and I want you to wordsmith on your own, but hopefully you have the idea now. Questions about the purpose statement? Now, let's move on. Yes, in any real report, we would write down a fully detailed procedure, but you already did a procedure for your pre-lab. Why would I make you type it up again? I know some instructors do, and maybe in earlier classes that's a good thing to do, but not a second year course. Now, if I was really being proper, I should say put some reference. If I really wanted to make us all annoyed, I would say put a bibliographic reference to the text in your lab report. But I'm not going to make you do that either. You know the procedure. I know the procedure. It's from the book. I told you which pages in the book, so why do we have to play this little dance where you tell me what I already know? So don't even mention procedure. Again, that's the wrong thing to do, but we're trying to simplify the reports a bit. So your next section is going to be data, which, let me say this sentence. Let me concoct one, though, one moment. The data indicates that a good result was retained. The data indicates that a good result was obtained. What's wrong with that sentence? Do you want me to say it one more time? The data indicates a good result was obtained. The data indicate a good result was obtained. Because data is a plural word. If you say the data is, that's bad grammar. The data are. Data comes from datum, the Latin term. Datum is the singular. So this datum is good. These data are good. I know that sounds silly, but if you listen to reporters on the news, the ones that are chemically trained, scientifically trained, they get it right. And the people that, like most of us, that just use the word in passing, we're so used to data is treating it singular that we'll say something like, well, that data is good. The data are good is proper English. And I point that out just so that you are educated scientifically. There'll be a few other little things like that that we'll cover today. But since I put the word data up, you should know how to use the word data. What are data? Because I'm going to have next section being a calculation section. So what are data then, and how is it distinct from calculations? That's right. It's whatever you directly observed. So it's whatever direct, again, qualitative or quantitative observations are made without any form of mathematical manipulation. As soon as you start mixing numbers, adding and subtracting, those are not data. Those are calculations. So data are direct, qualitative, or quantitative observations that require no manipulation. I'll even leave the word mathematical out. Now, organizing data into a table, that's not a calculation, that's organization. Printing a graph out from a set of data, that's just another representation of data. So that would still classify as data as well. The reason I make such a distinction between data, which are the observations, and calculations, which are your manipulations, is that in Chem 1, there's two types of mistakes that you can make. You might have an experiment that ripped really well, a titration, where you got perfect results, but you accidentally take the wrong numbers and put them in the wrong places in whatever equation that you're using. If you separate out and first show me an equation and then show me how you substitute it and have that all separate from your data, well, then I can tell where maybe a mistake was made. Now, this won't be such an issue in this course because we're hardly going to do any calculations here except sometimes percent yield or percent composition. So the syllabus makes a big deal out of this. I just made a big deal out of this, but most of the time we can take it a little more easy in this class. But you should know what the difference is. So what forms of data did you obtain? Mass of what? Mass of benzoic acid? Okay, so starting we had the mass of the mixtures. If the goal of this experiment is going to be the composition of the mixtures, you better know how much total compound you started with. What if you didn't write down the number? If you measured it out just to do the lab, but you didn't write it down? Don't lie about it. Just state in your lab report the combined mass of the mixture was not observed. Most of the time in this class, if you do good, or even you do crappy for your labs, if you have a bad lab experience, but you write it up beautifully, you'll get full credit. Because this is a first year organic chemistry course. You are not going to be able to walk in here and synthesize compounds and do it perfectly. It's just not going to happen. But can you interpret what happened? Do you know how to write about what happened? That's what's important to me. So if you make a mistake, if you spilled some compound and your data looked bad, I won't care as long as you make sure to carefully note what happened. So, combined mass of the two mixtures, benzoic acid, or another way to put it, the five different layers. You're going to have five masses. How would you organize that data? I might recommend something like this. Now, some of you may not know how to do this kind of trick, but it's easy to do a merge of cells in something like Excel. So if you have a bunch of rows, but you want to show that there's some relationship between them, take a cell that's to the, on the left, combine it, merge it, and for example, I could say these would be things referring to part A and part B. Since all you're taking is masses, it wouldn't look as good on paper to just say mass of this in words, mass of mixture A, and then put a number, mass of this compound number, mass of this compound number, because then you just got a grocery list. Visually not very attractive, makes it a little bit slower to interpret that data. If you put it in a table and give it some organization, though, same information, much more compactly presented, much more logically presented. So you don't have to do what I'm showing you, but you need to try to do something logical, some way to present that data. By doing this kind of thing where you merge, again, you can easily incorporate everything into one table. You could have your mixture and then first layer, second layer, mixture, first, second, third layer, all those masses listed out at once. So up at the top, I might have sample, whatever happens to be the mixture or the individual layer, and then mass in grams. If I put grams up at the top like that, I don't need to write grams every single place I write a number. Again, makes it a little visually more appealing. You always, 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 always have to put in units, though, either in the top of the table or on each number, one or the other. You can never presume that someone knows what units you're using, ever. A couple other fussy points. I will take points off of your lab reports if you write chemical formulas but don't do it correctly. What I mean is if you wanted to write something like this, does that look like a correct formula? No, what's missing? The subscripts. We don't write the numbers as big as the letters. That's an improper format. If you do it that way, that means you're too lazy to learn how to do subscripts. If you've never been forced to do subscripts, this is the 21st century, so you should learn how. No, because you're going to be applying for jobs, which means you're going to be writing resumes, which means you're going to be typesetting resumes. And if you do it yourself instead of paying someone to do it, you've got to know how to do some of these simple formatting tricks. So I expect that as second-year chemistry students, you know how to do subscripts. If you don't, tell me. I'll show you how. It's not that tough. Another very minor point that maybe I won't take points off for, but it'll make me roll my eyes. In English, for water, we say H2O. But at some point, because you all are so text-happy, that turned into H2O. There is no such compound as H2, the number 0. And are you thinking, wait, he really sees that as he's looking through our lab reports? Yeah, I've been a teacher too long now. And so I can see, just glancing at a paper, whatever font it is, oh, that's an O, oh, that's a 0. Again, very, very minor point, but if you're going to apply for an internship somewhere, and you quote water being H2, the number 0, someone else is going to see that and go, oh, okay. I just wrote down two perfectly valid English words. You know, ESL students, you know how crazy spelling is in English. But even besides that, when we have combinations that could be valid, that means your spell checkers won't catch it. So in Chem 1 all the time, I get people talking about Trail 1 and Trail 2, which means they had a good outdoor adventure. It's Trial 1 and Trial 2. So just check what you're writing. I'm not going to necessarily mark down points for bad grammar, but the simple things you need to be able to catch. Yes? Since what? Okay, so if you had, for example, a spill occur, right, what I would do is go ahead and write down a piece of data if you want to put a note next to it, like put a star and then down below just say, this mass was artificially low due to loss of compound, for example. That's how you can tackle that. Questions on the data section? Oh, well, we didn't finish, though, did we? Because we have the masses of the two mixture. We have the five masses of the individual layers. We also should have the mass of the benzoic acid after recrystallization, along with the melting point of benzoic acid. So those you should quote in your data section as well. Let's move on to calculations. So calculations are any mathematical manipulation of data. Yes. I was just getting to that. So those of you who've had me for previous chemistry classes, especially Chem 1A, the first lab where we do measuring of masses, I go off in this long discussion about what is a piece of data and what is a calculation. Exactly this situation. If you take a watch glass and get its mass, and then you put a compound on it and you get the combined mass, the mass of the compound itself is a calculation because you did not observe it. You observed the watch glass, you observed the combined mass, and by difference, you got the mass of the compound. But that means the mass of the compound is not a piece of data. However, this is not Chem 1A. And so again, to take it easier on all of us, I will let you ignore that kind of detailed measurement. Because often in publications, they don't want to see how did you get the mass of the compound, just what the heck was the mass. So no, you don't need to put beaker plus compound right out of the formula to do that mass by difference. But good question, because that came up, if no one asked it, I was going to tell you anyways. All right? So for masses, you could just refer all of them as data. But we do have percent composition. We do have percent yield that we're going to be calculating. Percent composition for the two mixtures, percent yield to figure out how much benzoic acid did you get back after the recrystallization. So just to make sure, let's write out some formulas. Oh, we have percent composition, percent yield, and then for the melting point, we'll have percent error. So let's define all three of these formulas. Percent composition, what would that be? Percent composition, how would you express that? Did you all not have your caffeine today yet? Don't everybody answer at once. Yes. Mass of the compound divided by the total mass times 100%, because we want it in terms of percentage. Then percent yield. What would that be? The mass measured. You're starting to do percent error. So mass measured divided by theoretical mass. So how much did you get versus how much should you have got? Multiply that by 100%. It's amazing how much general chem you forget over a summer, isn't it? Now, percent yield we'll use in the future for reactions, and we'll calculate the theoretical mass by a molar calculation. For this lab, the theoretical mass of benzoic acid is the combined mass of your two samples. Your mass measured will be what did you get after recrystallization. If you didn't measure the mass after recrystallization, then again, just tell me so. Don't make up your results, just be honest about them. Percent error. What is that equation? Experimental value minus the theoretical value divided by the theoretical value and then times 100%. This might be different than the formula you've seen in previous classes, because some people teach it with an absolute value sign thrown in. But that's silly in my mind, because if you leave it this way, you get from the number itself an indication of whether your error means that your value was too high or too low. If you put the absolute sign, then you always have to explain what the value is. But when you do it this way, if you get a positive error, you know that what you measured is too big. If you get a negative error, you know that what you measured is too small. Now, here's the way technically I have you do calculations. And you will encounter this for this lab because you are going to do percent composition, which means you're going to get several values. So the way to do calculations is first write out the equation in words or symbols. If you put variable names in, that's fine. Otherwise, write it out in words, just like this. This is so I know you know what the formula is supposed to be. If all I see is numbers and no explanation and you do it wrong, well, then it's hard for me to grade because I don't know which part you don't know. So write the equation out first. Take a set of data, put it in that equation, write out. Solve the equation. Show the substitution. But only do it once. If you do the same kind of calculation multiple times, after the 10th time you've showed me the substituted equation, am I really learning anything new? So only do a substituted equation once, and then make a table of all your results. Now for this experiment, maybe we'll blur the line between data and calculations. Because if we already have a nice table set up where I've got the samples labeled, I've got the masses, then what if I threw another column in? I shaded in a couple of these boxes because you can't have a percent composition for the whole mixture. And one of these masses you should measure is the entire mass of the mixture. But then otherwise, after you do your calculations to present everything as one compact block, you could go ahead and put the results of your calculation in your data table. So in other words, you can bend the distinction between data and calculations as long as you do it in a logical way. But for the percent composition, write the formula out. You can just copy the one I've got here. Throw numbers in from an actual set of data. Tell me which set of data that you're using to substitute. And then make a table of all the rest of your results. That process is described in the syllabus. For percent error, the only percent error you're going to do is for the melting point, which any time we measure something in here where that value is known, it's in the literature, you've got to compare your result to it. Otherwise, what's the point? So the accepted value of benzoic acid melting is 122.4. Different websites have different numbers. That was the most common one I saw, 122.4. But for melting points, percent error must always be done in what form of degrees? Well, actually, that was a badly worded sentence because Kelvin is not a degree, it's a scale. But it is Kelvin that we use. Why do we have to use Kelvin? Why can't we use Celsius? There's a physical problem and a theoretical problem. What's the physical, mathematical, I guess I'll say, problem? What's the normal freezing point of water? 0 degrees Celsius. So if I measured it 1 degree Celsius, what would the percent error be? You can't calculate it because you'd be dividing by zero. But you know it's a perfectly valid observation. It melts at a specific temperature. But you can't use Celsius. You can't use Fahrenheit. You can't use relative scales. You have to use an absolute scale, which is what the Kelvin scale is. This idea of an absolute scale comes up all over the place in thermodynamics. 0 degrees Celsius is undefined in too many equations. So always do your errors in Kelvin. That way also, if you do state a percent error, someone else that knows that it's supposed to be in Kelvin will know what the magnitude of that error really means. Questions about calculations? Yes?
For the magic point,
yep.
You're going to have like a several different number of melting points, so do you want us to put the average?
Yes, if you did observe a melting point range, usually the process is to average the extremes of the range and make that average your melting point. If you did multiple trials, average all those together to do your percent error.
Do you want to put it in the calculation?
It makes sense to do it in the calculations, yes. Although for percent error, if you want to put in your discussion, you can. Now, last two sections. Conclusion, or conclusions. This should be a summary of the, how did I say it this morning? A summary of the results of an experiment that addresses the goals as presented in the purpose statement. In other words, if in the purpose statement you said the goal was to determine the percent composition, then in your conclusion, state the percent composition. So this experiment, if your purpose statement is to determine the composition of two unknown mixtures, then in your conclusion, you would say the composition of mixture A is X percent benzoic acid, X percent naphthalene. The composition of mixture B is X percent benzoic acid, X percent naphthol, and X percent naphthalene, period, end of story. You might have already quoted those values somewhere in your data calculation sections. But the idea here is for people that don't really care and they're just kind of thumbing through to see what you did, they'll look at your purpose statement, see what was the what your goal was, and then they'll jump to the conclusion to see what the result was. Yes? It should be a sentence. For your data calculations, tables are fine, but your conclusions should be an actual written sentence. And then that's it. The last section would be discussion. And rather than writing a definition down, let me just talk about what the discussion section is and is not. Again, for this class, you don't have to talk about theory. If you want to, you can, but be careful. Because when you start talking about theory, I have to mark you off if you say things that are incorrect. That happens a lot in 1A. Someone starts with a good idea and then tries to take every topic they've heard related to it and stick it in there, again with this idea that the heavier lab report, the better. But no. Sources of error. Oh my gosh. This one drives me batty. If we were in a physics class, of course we would sit down and carefully analyze what's systematic error, what's random error. You know, we could, for every lab everywhere that you do a mass measurement, of course the balances might be miscalibrated. But I don't want you to tell me that, because did you sit down and calibrate the balance? Did you check if the balance was calibrated or not? This is not physics class, so we presume that our equipment works correctly. Human error, oh my gosh. I'll see sentences like this. The percent error might be artificially low because of human error. Well, fire the human and get a better one. That's what your boss would do, right? So be careful what you're writing in there. What do you put in the discussion section then? If you did have some literature result that you're comparing to, this would be the place to mention it. So if someone asks, where do I put the percent error for the temperature? You could put it in the calculation section. You might mention it here. The way you could mention it is if you say, for example, that the percent error for the melting point of benzoic acid was only 0.1%, which indicates that the benzoic acid is highly pure. That'd be a good sentence to put in. What other things can you put in there? If you had something that definitely went wrong, then you could mention it. But don't throw things in there just to make a discussion section. If your lab went beautifully, perfectly, nothing went wrong, you've got 0% error in your melting point, maybe you won't even have a discussion section. And that's it for the lab report. Again, due Wednesday, a week from today. Any questions about what to put in the lab report? Yes? Then make a comment wherever you put the mass down. Notate and say, this mass is lower than, how to say that better? The mass measurement is artificially low due to loss of material during the experiment.
In the data?
Right, and so what I suggested is not make your table look funny, just put a star or a plus or some sign there, and then down below, put that same sign and then write what you're trying to say. Let's now continue with the second experiment, which is our first introduction to a technique known as chromatography. Now, I asked a question this morning, and I guess that kindergarten has changed so much from when I was a kid that nobody had any idea what I was talking about. But I'll try to give the same example here. Did any of you as a kid ever do a type of experiment where you took a paper towel and you put a big ink blot on the paper towel and then put the paper towel in water to see what happens? You did. By one person, yay. So what happens when you do that? So the water crawls up the paper and the ink moves with it, right? But does it stay in one spot? And depending on what type of ink, actually, you might see the one dot turn into several. That is exactly an example of chromatography. Chromatography is a technique by which a mixture of compounds can be separated due to differences in their polarity, size, or charge. To keep this definition a little simpler, since this is the one version we're going to do for most of the quarter, I'm going to refer just to polarity today. Now, I totally got tongue-tied this morning. The ability to just make up sentences on the spot completely failed me this morning. So let me see if I can do a little bit better job with you all this afternoon. Because let me show you an example of a type of chromatography. This example will actually be for gas chromatography, but I'll define that formally in a minute. Imagine that we have some kind of tube. And that the inside of that tube, not the outside, is coated with some kind of material. For the sake of argument, let's just say that this is some kind of hydrophilic material. So something that's maybe very polar in nature. Imagine now that we allow vapor to pass through it. So again, what I'd drawn up here was something where the inside is coated with some kind of polar material. In real life, it's not always polar, just a good place to start talking from. So you have this material on the inside, then you pass a gas through it that might contain a mixture of compounds. Well, if the compounds themselves are polar, they're going to end up interacting with this polar coating. So as they progress through, they might get slowed down moving through because some of the time they're getting attracted to the coating. A nonpolar compound in this example, if it passes through, will do just that. It will tend to pass through without as much interaction. Because of this difference in polarities, because of the difference of the interaction with those compounds with that coating, you can therefore separate the compounds out. The different forms of chromatography all have this same kind of idea, where you have a stationary phase that contains some kind of separatory material that can separate the compounds, in this case on the basis of polarity. You then have a mobile phase, like in this gas example, maybe you'll have nitrogen, which is a non-reactive gas. You may take that to carry the volatilized compounds through the system. Different kinds of chromatography use different mobile and stationary phases, but it's still some kind of action of the phase passing through and then separation occurring. So let me see if I can give you a definition, a general definition for these. So the stationary phase is an immobile phase that contains a material that will separate compounds that's passed through it. There we go. I don't know if I used this word a moment ago, but support. Support means a platform or a structure or a piece of glass or a metal tube or something that provides the foundation upon which this compound that does the separating is applied. So it's an immobile support that contains a material that can separate compounds on the basis of polarity. Now you had a question.
When it separates, doesn't it actually hold one of the compounds?
It won't necessarily hold in the sense of bonding, but it holds in the sense that you have some kind of electrostatic interaction.
So it just breaks the bond, that's it?
Doesn't actually, there's no bond breaking going on. It's all plus and minus is being attracted.
Oh, I see.
Think of it like hydrogen bonding. If I had, which is exactly what you're going to have in this lab that you're doing, if I have some material that has a bunch of OH bonds on the surface of the material, and if I pass an alcohol that also has the potential to make hydrogen bonds over that, the alcohol won't bond, but it'll get tangled up, you could say, distracted by that separatory material. Now, you've got some solvent that's pushing it through also, so it won't get permanently stuck, but it'll get slowed down, which is the whole idea of how compounds end up being separated out. So let me wrap up the sentence here.
An immobile support that contains a compound that can separate the components of a mixture passed through it.
The mobile phase is therefore a non-reactant gas or solvent that carries the compounds through the stationary phase. Now, with those definitions, let me go back and recast this example as
an example of gas chromatography.
So in gas chromatography, it's exactly this situation. There's a long tube, usually called a column. That column may not be a column like you think, a structural building column, but column mean long tube, so long in fact that it's generally wrapped up in a loop. In that column, you pass a gas, either nitrogen, argon, helium, some kind of gas that's non-reactive, and at the point where you put your sample in, there's a heating element that vaporizes your sample. So it turns into a gas. The carrier gas, it's called, pushes that through the column, and as the different compounds interact differently with the surface of the column, they will come out of the column at different times.
So a sample is volatilized, which means evaporated. And passed through a column, a tube, that is coated on the inside with some form of separatory material. That is the stationary phase.
The sample is pushed through the column by some form of inert gas called the carrier gas.
And that carrier gas is the mobile phase.
We will be doing gas chromatography later in the quarter, so I'll talk more about how it works when we get there. To mention another type of chromatography, a very common kind, there is what's called column chromatography. And instead of writing out a definition, let me draw you a picture. So column chromatography usually looks like this, or works like this. You have some kind of tube, might look much like a pipette, might be the same size as a pipette on really small scale applications. On larger scale, it might be a few centimeters across, maybe half a meter tall, you know, substantially larger column. Still same general principle. On an industrial scale, it might be several meters tall and a meter wide, some huge kind of separatory device. In all these columns, it works this way. You pack the bottom of it with sand or rock or something non-reactive that provides a nice flat surface. Usually you'll finish off with sand, so the bottom of the column is perfectly flat, because you're trying to separate these compounds out by how far they travel through some kind of
material. And generally with these columns, we use something called silica gel.
Which is essentially just pulverized glass. So that pulverized glass has a somewhat polar surface. And so, again, the difference between polar and nonpolar compounds passing through this, that's what's going to separate the compounds out. When you prepare a column, you put all this material in there, and then you load the sample. You put your compound mixture at the very top of the silica gel and make a layer.
And then on top of that, you force through a solvent. You'll fill it up with solvent, and then often you'll actually add air pressure to push the solvent through the gel. So the solvent first mixes with your sample, dissolves it up, it starts carrying it through the silica gel. The different compounds will flow through it at different rates because some of them become entangled or interacting with the silica gel, others won't. So as the solvent comes through, you'll use a series of beakers or test tubes to collect the eluent, it's called, the stuff that comes through. And from that, you can separate your compounds. Yun, you had a question.
So the silica gel is not coated. It's gel that's like filled.
So in this case, right, you don't have a coating. This entire thing is filled with this powdery substance. It's a powder. To load the column in real life, what you do is you put that silica gel into some sort of solvent. It won't dissolve, but it'll make kind of a slurry. You pour that into the column, tapping the column as that stuff settles down, and you get a nice layer of material. If any of you have ever maintained a pool and have ever used diatomaceous earth to filter out leaves and such, same type of principle in a sense. You had a question. They're not trapped because otherwise you'd never get your compounds out. But they'll interact some more aggressively than others, and it's just electrostatic interactions. So think of it this way. Static electricity, not the same phenomenon, but close enough parallel. You get something that's got static electricity, two things will stick together. But then they'll come back apart again. And that's what's going on in this case. Two really polar materials will associate with each other for a brief period of time because they're both polar. But if you have a solvent that keeps on pushing through, eventually that solvent will make the compound move further on. No, there's different kinds of materials for different kinds of applications. But silica gel is one of the most common ones. So just so I don't get too bogged down at the moment, that's why I'm keeping my examples very narrow. But this is how column chromatography works. We will do column chromatography later. So let me now describe the technique that you're really going to be doing, which is abbreviated TLC, but it is not tender loving care. It is thin layer chromatography. ESL students, if you've never heard that phrase before, that's what in English TLC usually means, tender, loving care. Thin layer chromatography. Why is it called thin layer chromatography? Because it looks just like this. You usually have some kind of plate that has got either a plastic or glass backing to it. We have plastic backings to ours. And that plate is covered with some kind of material. You can see where some of it's been scratched off here. But this white material that's on here is silica gel, is some of this moderately polar material that I keep referring to. And think of the paper towel example I gave you at the beginning of this lecture. If I put a spot of something down at the bottom of this plate, place that in a solvent, allow the solvent to crawl up the plate by capillary action, well, then that sample will be brought along the plate, but maybe some components of that sample will stick more to the plate and travel more slowly, and other components won't interact with the plate as much and will move through the plate more quickly. That is what happens with thin layer chromatography. Now, this morning I kind of presented thin layer chromatography and then I redid it and then I redid it. So let me do kind of the same thing so we have an idea of what we're going for.
In thin layer chromatography, as I just said, you're going to put some compounds onto the plate. You have them at a starting point on that plate. You then allow solvent to pass through. Again, based on how much the compounds interact with the plate versus the solvent, the compounds will travel at different distances up the plate. When the solvent has reached the top of the plate, then you stop the development process. Why? Because once it has reached the top of the plate, different dots will have traveled different distances. And what we're going to calculate is the difference between how far the solvent travels versus how far each compound travels. From that, we're going to calculate something known as an RF value, which stands for retention factor. It is equal to the compound distance, which I've labeled C, divided by the solvent distance, which I'm calling S. If you have the same compound developed in the same solvent on the same kind of material TLC plate, RF values are reproducible. What is so great about that? Well, here's a scenario, the one that you're going to be doing for this experiment. Let's say that we had a painkiller tablet, an analgesic tablet. Analgesics tend to contain a limited number of compounds. Some of them are aspirin-based, so they'll have acetaminophen, or maybe you'll have something that's acetylsalicylic acid, or maybe a decomposition product that's salicylic acid. Or maybe you'll have other types of painkillers that have other essential compounds. In with that, some of them have caffeine. So what if we wanted to analyze one of these tablets? Well, we could arrange a selection of reference compounds. Get some pure acetylsalicylic acid, some pure salicylic acid, ibuprofen, these different compounds. Maybe some caffeine. And we put each of those reference compounds on a TLC plate and run it. Get those RF values. Then we take our tablet, crush it up, dissolve it up, filter it, take the mixture from that, put that on a TLC plate and develop it. If you end up with a plate where one of your target spots as at the same level as one of your reference compounds, then what we're going to say is that lets you identify what that spot is in your mixture. And so if we do this correctly, what that means we'll be able to do is identify simply by separation which of these reference compounds are in your painkiller tablet. That is the goal of this experiment.
So one more time through that. We're going to have reference compounds and your mixture that you make from a painkiller tablet. All of those things you're going to develop and run on a TLC plate. The reference compounds, you run those to establish RF values for each of the individual compounds. You run your mixture and figure out the different RF values for the multiple spots that you might get out of it. Where you can find a match of RF values, you identified one of the components in that mixture. Now, yes? What's that? Like I just said, we're going to be calculating RF values. So we take a known substance like caffeine. We make a TLC plate out of that, and we see how far caffeine travels. From that, we get the RF value. If when we run our tablet, we find the same RF value, that means we found caffeine. But you have to know what your reference compound is to then identify it in your mixture. So that's why we do known compounds and find their RF. So let me go over each one of these steps, because there's first preparing the TLC plate, getting the spots on the TLC plate, developing the plate, and then observing the plate. So those four things that we need to now tackle.
So first, preparing TLC plates.
So there's the TLC plate, and I need a starting point line on this plate. Why? Because if I'm measuring different distances, I need to have some common reference point. To do this correctly, we would hope that the bottom of a TLC plate is perfectly flat, and we need to draw a flat line across it. But there's a couple of things about that. For those of you who, like me, write really hard, put a lot of pressure, you got to be careful with a TLC plate, because you could just scrape the silica gel off of the plate, as I just did. So if you write too hard, you scrape it off. If you scrape off enough of it, the solvent won't pass through, because it's like you've made a barrier, so you ruin your TLC plate. So first thing off, don't write too hard. Second, you have to use pencil. Why? Because of exactly this example that I started out the whole lecture with. If you put pen and you're going to pass an organic solvent through it, you're going to dissolve that ink and it's going to crawl up the plate as well. Your compounds are going to end up being transparent. The ink will therefore mask the presence of these compounds. So you must use pencil and don't use too much pressure.
So to prepare the plate, you draw a line in pencil, a half or 1 centimeter from the bottom. At that starting line, you're then going to use what were called micro pipettes to make little spots on your TLC plate. We cannot use normal pipettes because the spots it would make would be gigantic, very likely would cover one side to the other of the plate. If the whole point of this technique is that we're trying to separate compounds and measure the distances that they travel, if you've got a blob that's huge, well, where do you mark the distance traveled from? The top of the blob, the bottom of the blob, the middle of the blob. So if you have a nice small compact dot, that makes it much easier to analyze a compound. Depending on how good your technique is, depending on how large the plate is, you can squeeze in 3, 4, maybe 5 different compounds on one TLC plate. If you can't get them all on one, it doesn't matter, because again, if you're using the same kind of plate and the same kind of solvent, then you're going to get reproducible RF values. So it doesn't matter if they all fit on one plate or not, in a sense. All right, so the plate is then spotted. With one or more compounds. That's it for the preparation of the plate. We then have the development of the plate. Associated with that, we have different TLC solvents. So during extraction, we talked about different common types of organic solvents. Some of those are the same solvents that you might use in TLC. I've said it in different ways so far today, but I'll say it one more time, that this TLC, this chromatography technique, is based on polarity. So let me just verbally express some examples. Let's say that you have a mixture of carboxylic acids that need separating from each other. Carboxylic acids are some of the more polar functional groups that you can run into. Particularly, they also experience a large amount of hydrogen bonding. So if you have silica gel, which has a lot of OH groups on the surface of that gel, and if you're passing a carboxylic acid over it, it may get stuck, not permanently, but stuck on that plate. If you don't use the right kind of solvent, like if you use a very non-polar solvent, more polar functional groups would be more attracted to the plate than a non-polar solvent. So when a non-polar solvent passes through the plate, maybe the dots won't move. So in that kind of situation, you need a more polar solvent. The more polar solvent would be able to push those dots along more effectively and cause more separation. But let's say we got a solvent that was too polar. That if it was too polar, it would just carry the dots as far as the solvent travels. You would lose the separation. So if it's not polar enough, or if it's too polar, you don't get good separation. So solvent or solvent mixture is chosen to give the optimal separation of the different compounds in the mixture being analyzed. In graduate school, the most common solvent set that I used was hexanes and ethyl acetate. Hexane, much more non-polar. Ethyl acetate, somewhat polar. Structure for ethyl acetate is in that list of common organic solvents that I gave.
So if you need a more non-polar environment, heavy on the hexane, just a smidge of ethyl acetate. If you need to push some more polar groups through, you might bulk up on the ethyl acetate. And TLC, oh, I should have mentioned this earlier. TLC is not just a technique for identifying components of a mixture or separating compounds. It can also be used to check the progress, the rate of a reaction. Because imagine that on a TLC plate, I put my starting material, and let's say I already knew what the product would be, and I put that on a TLC plate as well. If I have my starting material, the product, and then my reaction mixture all on the same plate, well then, once the plate's developed, I could see, is there only product present? Is there only reactant present? So it's a quick way to check the progress of a reaction, which if a reaction takes 3 hours, you kind of want to know if it's working or not. So in grad school, we had just a series of vials, each of us our own lab benches, where I'd have maybe 5% ethyl acetate, 15%, 25%, different levels of polarity. And anytime I was doing a reaction that I had not tested before, I'd make TLC plates and try them in the different solvents to see which ones gave me better separation. You don't have to do this in this lab. You'll have one solvent. But since some of you might be doing TLC in the future, I wanted to explain more fully how this works. So hexane's ethyl acetate, with the ethyl acetate being more polar. If you need something more polar still, then sometimes a chloroform acetic acid mixture is used. Chloroform is more polar than hexanes, and acetic acid is significantly more polar than ethyl acetate. It's in fact water soluble. It's so polar. So if you were separating a mixture of other carboxylic acids, this kind of solvent system might work better. As a side point, and I know this might be something you don't remember until you are a graduate chemist, but if you're doing column chromatography, some types of silicon gel go transparent in chloroform. Just happen to. Transparent, translucent. If you're separating a mixture of colored compounds, then you can do a really neat trick where you can watch those colors crawl down the column if you're using a chloroform solvent mixture. So, in this experiment, you'll be using ethyl acetate and acetic acid. Analgesics. Talked about the solvent. Where do we use the solvent? What kind of device are we using? So we have the development chamber. Which, before I write it down, let me just show you. Here it is, ever so fancy. But look what's in it. Piece of filter paper. Why do you think that we have this piece of filter paper in here? How many of you read the theory for chromatography? Same mistake as every quarter before of ignoring the lab theory until the day of the lab quiz, which means your average will be a 60% if you're following past years. Now, having just slapped you around like that, I will tell you that your lab book doesn't have as much detail, I believe. At least that's what they were telling me this morning, as what I'm going into here. But still, folks, read the theory, because I'm going to get to it, and you're going to get whammy. But now, since it might not be mentioned in there, you're just going to have to use your brains and come up with a reasonably educated guess. Yes?
Here's the directly related to visualization. Good guess. Yes. Is that in the lab theory?
Yeah.
It is exactly right. What does that mean, solvent equilibrium? You have this solvent that's crawling up the TLC plate. Well, solvents can evaporate, so what if it evaporates off the plate? That means the solvent never gets all the way up the plate. The dots don't travel very well. So you want to make sure that this is entirely saturated with the solvent to prevent solvent from evaporating off the plate. And that's the purpose of the filter paper, because as soon as you put solvent in there, the solvent crawls up the plate, crawls up the filter paper, evaporates off the filter paper, saturates the environment, and makes it more likely that your TLC plate will develop correctly. Notice that the filter paper does not go all the way around. And again, it's not because of visualization. Of course, you want to be able to see your plate. And we'll talk about why in a moment. But aside from that, why would you not want this filter paper to go all the way around? That's right, either the top or the sides. Because if the sides of the TLC plate touch the solvent, then the solvent's going to flow this way. And you want to only flow one direction through your TLC plate. So. Oh, and I guess the last comment, when you're using the TLC chamber, make sure the lid is on there. Because if the lid's open, then everything evaporates.
So again, comment about the filter paper. Use to ensure that the interior of the chamber is fully saturated with solvent. To prevent solvent evaporating off the plate. You'll have your TLC plate in there, leaned up against the wall, but the TLC plate must not touch the filter paper. Otherwise, solvent may flow across, side to side, the TLC plate. There is one more important point. If I make a flat view of the chamber, and here's the TLC plate. And here's my starting line. Then I better make sure that the solvent level is below the starting line. Why? Well, what happened if the starting level was above the line? They would go away. They wouldn't travel up the plate because if they're already in the solvent's just going to dissolve the dots. And then everything goes up the plate together.
So you have to allow the solvent to pass through the dots from below. Cannot allow the dots to be dissolved beforehand. Now the last item, when do we stop? Once it gets up towards the top, do we want it to touch the very top of the plate? No, because we do need to make sure that we have a clear viewing of where that solvent front, it's called a solvent front, just like a weather front, to see how far that solvent front progresses. The way you can tell that is you'll just look in your chamber, you can see how far the solvent has crawled up the plate, and when it gets about the same distance from the top as your start line is from the bottom, that's where you pull the plate out of the mixture. As soon as you pull it out of the development chamber, the solvent's going to evaporate. Since you need to measure how far the solvent went, because that's part of your RF calculation, as soon as you pull it out, immediately mark a line where the solvent had gotten to.
So once the solvent reaches near the top of the plate, remove the plate from the chamber and mark the position of the solvent front.
The last aspect of this, then, is
visualization. Which, in some cases, can be a bit tricky.
Like this lab, all of the compounds you're going to be using are clear or colorless, or if there are some colors, some very light yellow. Something light enough that you most likely won't be able to see it at all on your TLC plates. However, this is not just silicon gel that's on here. This has a UV reactive dye on it as well. So wherever UV light hits the plate, it's going to glow green. You can see the green from where you're sitting, right? I know that light's shining on it too. Well, if your compounds interact with UV light, that means it's going to absorb the UV light. If your compound absorbs the UV light, then that means the UV light doesn't make it to the plate, which means that point where the compound is will look like a dark spot on your plate. So once you take this out of the solvent chamber, let it dry out, shine the UV light on it. Don't sit there and look at the UV light. Shine it on the TLC plate, and then circle all the spots that you see on the plate. The only drawback to that is, what if your compound doesn't react with UV light? Then it'll pass right through, and you won't know it's there, because it will appear just as a normal bright spot, as like the rest of the plate.
But it's a good first step. It's a non-destructive visualization, because all you're doing is shining light on the TLC plate. Some forms of silica gel contain a dye that's responsive to UV light.
If a spot contains a compound that also is active to UV, that spot will absorb the UV light and will therefore appear as a dark spot against the TLC plate.
Let me put in parentheses here, non-destructive.
Now, because that's not always good enough, there are some other visualization techniques. One that might have been mentioned in your procedure, but I'm going to try to skip, is putting the TLC plate into an iodine chamber, a chamber where you just fill up with some iodine crystals. Iodine, for whatever reason, will stick to certain compounds more than others. It will stick to organic compounds much more than it would silica gel. And so where your spots are, in general, the iodine will clump up and you'll get these dark brownish, yellowish, orangish spots that appear. But there's an even better technique, which is to use what's called a chemical stain. And in that technique, the TLC plate is dipped into a compound that will react in some way with the spots on the plate. There are different compounds used for different types of compounds, different classes of chemicals. The most common stain that we used in grad school was based off of this compound. So that's benzene that's got an aldehyde functional group at one end, and then a methyl group attached to the to an oxygen on the other end. This compound is known as para-anisaldehyde. Which, if you know anything about plants or cooking, anise is a plant that has seeds or the plant itself that has a licorice taste to it. And anisaldehyde takes its name from this anise plant. Just happens to react with a variety of functional groups and turns different colors, which it's been long enough since grad school, I don't remember which ones are which, but I seem to remember ketones often go orange, alcohols often go pink, carboxylic acids go purple. But at least they'll change colors, which again gives you the dots. But this is a destructive technique. Because you're causing a chemical reaction. Once you have your dots, you measure the distance the dots travel versus the solvent front, and that way you can calculate your RF factors. Now we have one more thing that we need to talk about today, and to do so we're going to gather over at the fume hoods. For the sake of the recording, this is just going to be a demonstration of how to correctly light a Bunsen burner, and then how to make micro pipettes.